From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain faces an onslaught of questions related to sexual harassment claims he at first denied and then said he'd been falsely accused. The report first came up in Politico.com. But brought to light sexual harassment accusations against him from the late 1990s. The National Restaurant Association paid two female employees to settle harassment complaints against Mr. Cain. At the time, he was head of the association. What the claims could mean for Herman Cain's presidential prospects and current perspectives on sexual harassment. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Stock prices have opened sharply lower on Wall Street following declines on foreign markets. The Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 200 points. Analysts say the sell-off was triggered by the surprise decision by Greece's government to hold a referendum on the latest package of bailout loans to head off a default there. The concern is that Greek voters may reject the package and the austerity measures it requires. The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin says that could throw into doubt the wider plan hammered out last week to address Europe's debt crisis.
The formal response of the German government is to say it expects Greece to keep the commitments it made at the summit only 7 days ago. Informally, though, there is clearly much disquiet. Rainer Brüdeler, the economics minister until recently and still a powerful government figure, said he was irritated. "This sounds to me like someone's trying to wriggle out of what was agreed. A strange thing to do," he said on German radio.
The BBC's Steve Evans in Berlin. France's president, Nicolas Sarkozy, is holding an emergency meeting to discuss Greece's referendum decision. He's hosting a summit of the world's 20 leading economies this week on the French Riviera, a meeting expected to focus on the European debt crisis. October was the best month in 9 years for the U.S. stock market, with the Dow Industrials gaining 9.5%. But Sam Stovall, chief equity analyst for Standard & Poor's, says investors remain cautious, especially considering the uncertainty in Europe.
Some people wanted to be able to lock in some gains for the month, but at the same time, there continues to be lingering doubts about the success or potential success of the European debt crisis. So that's a problem I think is going to be with us for quite some time.
Federal Reserve policymakers begin their monthly meeting in Washington today. They are not expected to make any changes in monetary policy. New sentencing guidelines for people convicted of crimes involving crack cocaine take effect today. The change, which applies retroactively, will mean reduced sentences for thousands of federal prisoners. NPR's Kerry Johnson reports nearly 2,000 prisoners are eligible for immediate release.
For decades, people convicted of having crack cocaine rather than the powder form of the drug served much longer prison terms. The penalty had a disproportionate impact on minorities, and civil rights groups fought hard to reduce those disparities. Advocates now say the change means the prison system could save more than $200 million over the next 5 years by shortening the sentence of many inmates by about 3 years. Kerry Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Utility crews are working to restore power to about 1.3 million homes and businesses in the Northeast that are still without electricity following a weekend snowstorm. More than half of the outages are in Connecticut. Officials there say it could take days to restore power completely. Checking Wall Street, the Dow is currently down 246 points. The Nasdaq Composite Index is off 61. This is NPR News. Federal authorities in Arizona have broken up a massive drug smuggling network run by a Mexican drug cartel. Matthew Allen, a special agent with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, says 76 people have been arrested.
We took out the whole network by focusing not just on the lower-level organizational members, but command and control members that were in Arizona directing the operations of lower-level organizational members.
Allen says the network was smuggling more than $33 million worth of marijuana, cocaine, and heroin across the border into desert areas of Arizona each month. The drugs were then sold to distributors from other states. Officials say the operation generated an estimated $2 billion in profits over the past 5 years. GOP presidential candidate Herman Cain's campaign appears to have benefited from undisclosed support by a Wisconsin corporation called Prosperity USA. NPR's Peter Overby reports the firm was incorporated by Mark Block, now Cain's campaign manager.
Last winter, Mark Block headed up two groups. One was Prosperity USA. The other was Friends of Herman Cain, a trial balloon for the presidential race because Cain hadn't officially announced. Internal documents obtained by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel show that Block's Prosperity USA paid at least $38,000 for Cain's travel, iPads, and other items. It indicated that Block's Friends of Herman Cain would reimburse it. But there's no public record of that happening, and Cain's campaign did not respond to NPR's query. Without those reimbursements, Prosperity USA could have made illegal corporate contributions to the Cain presidential operation, and there's no record of where Prosperity USA got its money. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
And I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the U.S. Oncology Network, more than 1,000 oncologists united to bring cancer care to communities across America. USOncology.com.
For joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Herman Cain, a top contender in the GOP presidential race, faces a barrage of questions over allegations of sexual harassment. At first, he flatly denied the report and then said he'd been falsely accused. Joining me to talk about the issues and their implications for his presidential bid, Emma Coleman Jordan of Georgetown University Law School, John Harris of Politico.com, Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post, and joining us from a studio at KUVW in Denver, Colorado, Erica Salmon Byrne of Corpedia, Inc., that's an ethics, compliance, and risk assessment consulting company. Of course, you are welcome to be part of the program. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
John Harris, if I could start with you. Politico.com broke the story of these allegations. He first denied them, now says he's falsely accused. What's the latest?
The latest is he effectively acknowledged the thrust of our story. And Diane, I could say that that's a story that we've been working on for almost three weeks, involving a number of reporters who had been working at this from a number of different angles and a number of editors who were holding this up to the light from multiple angles. As you can imagine, it's a difficult, sensitive story. What we published, Herman Cain, as you said in your intro, first effectively denied the story first declined comment, then denied, then throughout the course of yesterday acknowledged the two main thrusts of our story. One, that there had been sexual harassment allegations against him when he was at the National Restaurant Association. Two, that these had been settled. Lots of questions still out there unanswered. Precisely what was the behavior? What was the actual process by which these were settled? What was the disposition of these? And is there broader context to this?
John, how did these allegations first come to light at Politico?
Like most stories of this kind, through a tip, through somebody who had heard about it. I will say, without getting into too much detail about our sourcing, the original tip was not somebody who was in position to corroborate what the source had, what this person had heard. So I consider them really more of a tipster than a source. But that tip was interesting enough that we did go about reporting and find actual sources who did indeed have understanding, firsthand understanding of what was of what happened at the NRA
Can
in the 1990s.
Can you confirm or refute the idea that the tip came from one of Herman Cain's political challengers?
Diane, I cannot.
You cannot do either. You cannot confirm or refute.
No, I've elected not to do that. I think that's the details of our reporting. We're trying to share as many of them as we can, but what we share is what we publish, and I don't think I can go into a lot of the plumbing of the story. But I should say, I can add, I don't think that particular fact is material to our understanding of the set of facts in public debate. What we published was reported, carefully edited. So the question of motive to me seems quite secondary to the question of what exactly happened.
John Harris, he's editor-in-chief of Politico.com. Turning to you, Ruth Marcus, do you think that motive remains secondary?
In terms of how Politico got the story, I actually completely agree with my friend John Harris. I think, first of all, Politico deserves an enormous amount of credit, especially in the competitive 24/7 news environment that we live in, for taking what seems from the outside, from reading the story and hearing accounts of it, to have been extreme care in handling a very sensitive story. The Cain campaign had 10 days, which is an eternity these days in journalism, to formulate a response to Politico. And I think all sources have some motive or another. And the question is whether the nugget that they bring to you is A, relevant, and B, developed to a point that you can get it in your newspaper or online. And that's what Politico did.
And you wrote yesterday that the response to these allegations is a textbook example of how not to handle
it. And the amazing thing was that it got worse and worse and worse as the day went on yesterday, because if you remember, Herman Cain started the day by saying, "I didn't do it." And not only did I not do anything, but I don't know anything about a settlement. I went to the National Press Club to see him yesterday and was, you know, one of the weirder moments in my journalism career has been listening to a presidential candidate sing on request. That was kind of fun, as were the 999 cupcakes. But he said at the press club that he didn't know of any settlement, as he had said on Fox News. Well, by the time he was on the NewsHour and then on Greta Van Susteren, he was at details about what might have happened with these women. And, oh, yes, there was a settlement. So it was just a very bizarre and unprofessional handling of a difficult situation.
And Emma Coleman, Jordan, there have been immediate comparisons to allegations against Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Ann Coulter called this another white liberal lynching. How do you see it?
I think that the initial response by Clarence Thomas was over the top and an exaggeration of our history with racial violence and appropriation of this dark history for his personal defense. And Ann Coulter's use of it similarly is inappropriate, inapplicable. Let me just say why I think it's inapplicable. First of all, with Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, we had two human beings who could present themselves to the public and the public could judge. Eventually, at the end of the process, she did present herself to the committee and the people could judge. Here we have a one-sided story, and the key to the other side of the story, we hear from Herman Cain, we hear from his representatives, but the other side of the story, the women, we've not seen, we've not heard, and the question is why. We understand from the reporting that there is an agreement that prevents them from speaking. Herman Cain is seeking the office of the presidency of the United States. We ask for tax returns, medical reports. He has the keys to unlock these women to be judged in the public eye by waiving whatever agreement he signed them to let them speak.
Emma Coleman Jordan, she represented Professor Anita Hill in the long ago clash between Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill that ended up in worldwide publicity and in hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Turning to you, Erica Salmon Byrne, how do you think our understanding of what constitutes sexual harassment has changed in the last 20 years?
Thank you, Diane. We've seen a really remarkable change, I would say, over the course of the last 20 years. In our context, helping companies design programs that keep their employees from getting the organizations into situations like the one that the NRA found itself in, we've seen a tremendous rise in awareness of appropriate workplace behavior, and we've seen tremendous rise in awareness of the way to handle these kind of allegations. One of the things that I found most interesting about the political reporting was the interviews with members of the advisory board who, at least on the record, indicated they were completely unaware of these allegations. Now, that simply wouldn't happen nowadays in an organization that has a best-in-class investigation protocol, that has a matrix that raises these kinds of allegations involving a senior executive to the board level. We saw that just earlier this year with the situation that Mark Hurd got himself into at HP. The board was incredibly involved because the allegations involved the CEO. And so I found that piece of the political reporting to be particularly interesting because that is so contrary to the way we see things being handled these days.
And you give advice to companies. What do you tell them about sexual harassment?
We tell them that they really need to think about two primary things from an organizational perspective. One is having the right written standards in place, policies, procedures, a code of conduct that talks about the way we treat each other in the workplace, the way we behave with each other in the workplace, making sure that everybody feels comfortable in the workplace. One of the things we've seen over the course of the last several years is a remarkable rise in males reporting harassment by female superiors. And so this isn't simply a male-to-female thing any longer. We're seeing same-sex harassment claims, things along those lines. And so standards and then training is really the next critical thing.
Erica Byrne, Assistant General Counsel and Director of Corpedia, Inc. We'll take a short break here. When we come back, we'll talk further and take your calls.
Thank you.
And welcome back. We're talking about sexual harassment and specifically the accusations of sexual harassment against Herman Cain that have been published by Politico.com. Here with me in the studio, John Harris. He's editor-in-chief of Politico.com, author of The Survivor, and co-author of The Way to Win. On that very point, Ruth Marcus, what should Herman Cain have said as soon as he heard the charges, the question from Politico?
He should have figured out what the situation was. He should have asked Politico for time to do that. Then he should have figured out the answer to your question depends on the facts of how bad the underlying conduct was. But he should have gotten out his story on his own terms, in his own words, as fully and cleanly as possible. So you don't have two things. So you don't have a story that's changing over the course of a day, not to mention a week. And so you're not inciting people who have a different version of the story to come out and tell their own story. Because when he says these were false accusations and they were found to be without merit, as a journalist, I can tell you the fact that these women signed nondisclosure agreements is not going to end up binding them. Who is going to sue them for violating their nondisclosure agreement when they have been denied and contradicted in that way?
Emma.
Yes, I think this is a key to the difference in this case. This was settled through an internal complaints procedure, and as the facts are unfolding, it appears it was a shortened, reduced, limited circle of people involved. Yesterday, we heard from Mr. Cain that the human resources director of the Restaurant Association was involved, and through reporting, political reports, no, not the human resources director, who would be the appropriate person to be involved in this kind of settlement.
Then who was, John?
I don't know, Diane, the truth of what happened. All I know is that we have conflicting testimony. We have Herman Cain's comments that the human resources director at the National Restaurant Association was involved. She had previously told us, before Herman Cain's comments, that she knew nothing about this. So there's an obvious contradiction there. I can't square that circle. I don't know the facts. I do know that I don't think an internal procedure is probably too grandiose a description of it. My understanding of this, that this was handled in an improvisational way, not through procedure. Or in any event, if there was a procedure, if there was some kind of internal adjudication of this, our extensive reporting with board members, staff members, and others with firsthand awareness didn't find that. So that's a question mark in my mind.
Do you believe that the Cain group and those who know and support him had any inkling that this was coming to the fore and therefore could have been prepared for the question that came from the reporter at Politico.com?
You're referring to the Cain campaign or his old organization at the National
Cain
Restaurant?
Campaign.
The Cain campaign.
Sorry for being confusing.
No, I did not get a sense that they had. Except in the vaguest terms, there had been discussion of this previously. Herman Cain had apparently told some campaign staff members, you know, there's this thing out there that's been settled and no problem. They didn't have details and didn't have any of the context, but they were aware of the possibility of something out there, according to our reporting. I can tell you from my vantage point, it did not seem that they had any kind of specific plan or strategy for handling those inquiries when they did, in fact, come.
You know, some people in the public might feel that the Politico.com reporter who posed the question was there to do a gotcha. And I find myself wondering how, you know, if I didn't know something was coming, how I might have reacted.
Can I take a response to that,
sure,
Diane? Our inquiry to them about was made through the campaign apparatus on October 20th.
So it was made privately.
That's correct. Yeah, just the same way any sort of reporter inquiry is. We reached out to the campaign director of communications on October 20.
I see.
There had been repeated interactions between October 20 and October 30, which was the date when Herman Cain appeared on Face the Nation at CBS. It was my judgment as editor, we can't publish this, even though they haven't been responsive to us in any kind of detailed way. We still should not publish this until we can talk to Cain directly, not through his proxies. And so it was my judgment to send Jonathan Martin out there to talk to Herman Cain. I didn't consider it a gotcha that these matters had been put before him privately for 10 days.
Ruth Marcus.
I totally agree. I think John and Politico would have been negligent not to take the opportunity to get to the candidate directly. And I want to say one more thing, because Emma is such a temperate law professor type and I'm an over-the-top columnist type. I just find myself, once again, actually enraged by the notion that race had anything to do with this. If anything, I suspect that John and Politico were ultra careful because of the emanations and echoes of the Clarence Thomas hearings. But there is simply absolutely no indication. We don't know if these women are African American or white or Asian or anything else. There is no indication of any racial animus or echo or involvement or anything else, and the only people who have brought up race are Herman Cain's defenders, and I would like to say shame on them.
Emma.
I agree with that. You know, I think that we are in a season, the presidential campaign season, where we've seen this story before. It has nothing to do with race and everything to do with sexual imposition, sexual indiscretion. Do you remember John Edwards and the stories that began to unfold about an affair and about a videographer and the denials? And then, you know, it just gradually came out.
And he finally,
he is in court now.
Of course.
About the allegations that he used campaign funds. The point I want to make is that these allegations are allegations that came forward in the mid-90s. Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill had their stories told in 1991. This would have been an environment of very heightened, in the mid-90s, of very heightened sensitivity to male behavior in the workplace, and that includes off-premises trips to hotels and social things afterwards. So I'm shocked, really, that we're getting a report that there was a settlement with a non-disclosure agreement that prevented – these women were dismissed from their jobs. They lost their jobs in a settlement. And we are getting
I should say, Emma, that last detail is something that I cannot speak to on the basis of our reporting. I do not have the detailed chronology of their exit and the terms of that exit were. I know that there were departures. I know that there were settlements with non-disclosure agreements around those settlements, and those settlements came after they leveled complaints of sexual harassment. But I cannot say that they lost their jobs because of it. I just don't know that.
John,
well, the
Harris
causation part of it we may not have, but it is a fair inference to say that these women leveled complaints. They no longer worked for the employer against whom the complaints were
leveled. I think it's fair to say that they found their work situation and continued employment there to be not a tenable option.
We don't have their story, and that is the problem you have, I have, Ruth has, everyone has.
Let me ask John Harris directly, has Politico.com identified these women yet?
Yes, we have. As we said in the article, that we do know their identities, and
have
elected not to publish them for privacy consideration.
Have you been in touch with them? Has Politico been directly in touch with them?
Diane, as you can appreciate, in a situation like this, I'm better off fulfilling my responsibilities by sticking precisely to what we published, and we have not answered the question you just asked in our published reports.
There are an awful lot of people out there who would say, how can you publish the name of the accused without identifying the accusers? I realize there's a non-disclosure statement. Ruth Marcus, politically, how does that play?
Well, I think it's a very hard call, and I'm glad I was not in John's shoes as an editor. It brings in the sort of very amorphous and emotional nature of sexual harassment allegations. So John says that Politico elected not to publish their names out of respect for their privacy. Well, it's a sort of no-brainer for most news organizations, though we've had debates about it in the past, not to publish the names, for example, of rape victims, because it's a personal matter of having been raped. Now, is having been the subject of or target of sexual harassment or alleged sexual harassment comparable to rape, so that you're really interfering with somebody's privacy? I actually can see an argument not, but on the other hand, I would feel very bad to drag a woman who wanted to put all of this behind her out into the public limelight, having done nothing to make this public, and perhaps having asked me not to make her name public.
Erica Byrne, how do you advise companies, corporations to deal with this kind of situation when an employee has taken a buyout, perhaps, or has left the company? How do you advise companies to deal?
Diane, the thing that we usually see in these kinds of situations, and let me just say, you know, we've heard from a lot of people talking about the Herman Cain situation. It's not uncommon to resolve these kinds of situations financially without necessarily reaching the merits of the allegations 100%. You know, in the legal jargon, we call it a nuisance settlement. You know, we're just going to pay some money to make this go away. I don't know whether that was the situation here. The fact that there's more than one woman, the fact that there are multiple allegations, you know, indicates that, and of course the fact that we're not seeing any evidence that there was really any significant internal inquiry into what happened, make me wonder whether that was actually the situation here. But that does happen relatively regularly, and what we always recommend is making sure that you really got your ducks in the row as far as the facts are concerned first, and that really doesn't seem to have happened here. So, if you're going down the road of settling a situation like this, if you're looking at a non-disclosure agreement, if you're looking at the terms that go along with the separation of an employee from the organization, you always want to make sure that you understand what happened and that the relevant people within the organization have been alerted to what happened. And again, that doesn't seem like it happened here.
Erica Byrne of Corpedia Inc., and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email which says, I cannot understand why the Cain campaign did not have the press release all typed up and ready with the facts and exculpatory information. If he wants to be president, he has to be able to anticipate problems. Certainly, he knew this could be a problem at some point. Ruth Marcus.
Bingo. That's all I have to say.
All right, let's open the phones. Let's go to Osage, Oklahoma. Good morning, Rosemary. You're on the air.
Hello. First of all, hello to Emma Coleman Jordan. I know her, met her at a conference in Atlanta. But my question is to anyone who might have information, is there anything on the public record about this? I guess there was no question of criminal charges, but did any court become involved? Is there any way to get information that isn't filtered through the Cain campaign?
John.
Well, there's certainly a way to get information that's not filtered through the Cain campaign through reporting. In the course of our reporting, we did not find, and we did, of course, look for anything on the public record in some sort of legal setting, as the caller describes.
All right. To Sugar Land, Texas, Prem, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Simple thing, common sense in America is that you are innocent until proven guilty. But what I have found time and time again is that in case of allegations, especially in media, a person is guilty and can never be proven innocent. Now, look at the facts here. We don't know who are the accusers. We don't know what exactly happened. What I read in the story was there was a specific word said, not overtly sexual conduct. Now, what does it mean? Did he say something or he ever said anything? My question is, how can a media present a story like this without having proper evidence?
John.
Herman Cain is not in a court of law. He is a candidate for president about whom every significant chapter in his career that sheds light on his capabilities to be president, on his character to be president, is relevant. I can appreciate the caller's point of view and understand his feeling. A couple of things to say about this. One, Herman Cain was aware with specificity and a special specificity in one of the cases what and who the accusations came from. This information is not unknown to him. We're more detailed than the caller describes in describing the behavior, the alleged behavior that took place.
Which was?
Comments that were clearly, in the, as we understand them, sexually suggestive in nature, that made the woman angry and uncomfortable and prompted them to level complaints. In the case of physical gestures, those were not, based on our reporting to date, necessarily overtly sexual, but they were considered quite inappropriate from the woman's vantage point and from the vantage point of people who witnessed this in ways that they found odd, uncomfortable, and inappropriate.
John Harris, he's editor-in-chief of Politico.com. We'll take just a short break here. When we come back, more of your questions, your telephone comments. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
The Environmental Outlook. Plastic bags, bottles, and other trash are turning the world's oceans into what some call plastic soup. What can be done to save our oceans? The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Thank you.
I think we need to step back just a bit and get an idea of what really constitutes sexual harassment these days, and perhaps for all time, but certainly these days. I'll start with you, Ruth Marcus, and then go to Erica.
Well, I think that one of the things that the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings taught us now 20 years ago is that sexual harassment can be a very ambiguous, contextual event. And so if John, sitting next to me here, were my editor, and he said to me, in order for you to continue working here at Politico, Ruth, you need to sleep with me, otherwise I'm going to fire you, nobody would disagree about whether that was sexual harassment. But if we've known each other, as we have, for more than 20 years, and we've had a joking relationship, and he's joking with me in a way that he thinks is perfectly appropriate but might make me uncomfortable, there's going to be a gray area, and it depends on what our relationship is. Are we coworkers? Is he my supervisor? How far over the line is he? Have I communicated to him that it's made me uncomfortable? And so that's what makes, when Herman Cain came out and said, I never sexually harassed anybody, that was only, or should only have been, the beginning of the inquiry. What exactly did these women say, and were you adequately attentive to their obvious feelings of discomfort?
And Erica, from your perspective, what is it that you advise your corporate executives to be very, very conscious and aware of?
Yeah, thank you, Diane. First off, Ruth is exactly right. I mean, there's a spectrum when we're talking about sexual harassment. At one end is the very obvious quid pro quo type situation that she just alluded to, and then at the other end is overt, is gestures, jokes, comments that make individuals within the workplace feel uncomfortable. Now, you know, there are a couple of things that have come out in the political reporting around the Cain situation that are textbook from my perspective. Anybody that's taken a sexual harassment training course over the course of the last 10 or 15 years would have seen these kinds of situations in that training course. And of course, you know, now these days, sexual harassment training is actually required for any company that has employees in California, Connecticut, or Maine. So there are state legislatures that are actually mandating training on this particular topic. But things like, for example, inviting somebody up to your hotel room. Never a good idea. I could see a certain context in which you might say, hey, I need to go grab something, come upstairs with me, and then let's go get some dinner or something along those lines. But really, at the end of the day, if you're on the road with colleagues, not a good idea.
Absolutely.
To say, hey, come on back to my room. We'll have another drink. That's setting yourself up for a situation.
Here's an email from Don, who says, the Herman Cain and all similar situations represent the worst of both politics and journalism. If someone wants to get anything negative out in the public, they just throw the red meat to the media, who do the dirty work for them under the guise of journalism. Emma, how do you see it?
I think that's an unfair characterization of the role the media plays. They are our ears. They are our curiosity in places of power. And if you put yourself forward as a presidential aspirant, you are entering a zone of intense scrutiny. And you, when they say presidential campaigns are different, what they mean is the searching level of inquiry, the sheer person power that is going to chase down every detail, is what we in a democracy deserve and expect of the Fourth Estate.
John,
this is
Harris,
what they do for us.
How do you react to that comment?
I can understand it. Obviously, my view, and not just my view, but how I've defined my professional responsibility is more like what Emma says. I feel that we need to know everything that we can learn about presidential candidates. That doesn't mean just putting up a rumor, innuendo, allegation, It means doing journalism, which is reporting, trying to find out what happened, and then putting that reporting through a careful editing process in which we're trying to measure accuracy, fairness, relevance.
Let's go to Brunswick, Maryland. Good morning, Perry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. As usual, thanks for your very timely broadcast of this program. I've been listening to the discussion, and I have to back up what John says and also the lady who's familiar with sexual harassment and equal employment opportunity in general. I served as an EEO counselor for 5 years as a collateral duty with the Department of Labor in Chicago, and regional EEO officer used to give me the most, she said she gave me the most complicated cases that she had because she knew that I could handle them. From what Mr. Kane says about what he did, it doesn't compute with the outcome of the complaint. That's really my only input. And as a 60 plus white male, I've been in situations before with personal friends where I've overstepped, or I should say gotten off track. And if I hadn't listened, I wouldn't be friends with these people today.
That's an interesting comment.
I've been on both sides of this, and yeah. It just doesn't seem to me that a five-figure settlement would have been even on the table in an EEO office if the behavior had been what Mr. Kane has publicly said it was.
Has it been confirmed that it was a five-figure settlement, John Harris?
Diane, that's what we published in our story, and I would acknowledge five figures leaves a lot of room between 10,000 and 99,000. But that was what we were comfortable publishing.
All right, and here's another email from Peg. She says, how come Bill Clinton and John Edwards got a pass in the media, but Kane does not? John Edwards and his mistress were ignored by the media. With Bill Clinton, it was, quote, that it was his private life, not his public life. But with Mr. Kane, if this allegation is true, it's a moral issue. I don't mind the questioning of the candidates. I expect every single candidate to go through the same grilling by the press until the mass media splash similar headlines for both Democrats and Republicans. I'm not going to trust anything the media says about any candidate, Emma.
I think that this is not a fair comparison. President Clinton was impeached. Let's remember that. John Edwards is now in the dock of a court around the very allegations that came forward toward the end of his campaign. So Herman Cain, on that spectrum between impeachment and legal accountability in a court for campaign spending on a mistress, is at the very light end of the spectrum. He is getting only inquiries.
Go ahead, Erica.
Sorry, I had to jump in there with one other distinguishing factor here, because even if we go back to the time when President Clinton was running and there were allegations of mistresses and things along those lines, that was not a workplace situation. Those were relationships that he was allegedly having and Edwards was allegedly having with individuals who were outside of his employment. In this situation, the allegations are that Herman Cain acted inappropriately towards people who were working with him or for him, and that is a very different set of allegations than merely having being unfaithful to one's spouse.
All right, let's go to Tim in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Hey, Diane. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I love your show.
Thanks.
I have two comments. I'm going to come back on what the lady just said. She said Bill Clinton's was a personal affair and it wasn't in a workplace like Herman Cain. But Bill Clinton, it still speaks to your character as president. And John was saying that, you know, that when they become presidential candidates, that their character is accountable to the public. So that would still be accountable. So I think she's not accurate when she says that, because Bill Clinton's character still should have been held accountable. Now, Herman Cain, earlier she has spoken about Herman Cain had come out with a lie by denying it. Well, if he hadn't done it, then he wasn't lying. He was telling the truth. He just didn't add that he had been accused. And you had said earlier that, you know, it would be tough if you were blindsided by – it would be very hard if the media has come up and blindsided that when you weren't expecting it. How would you answer that? If you was answering it truthfully, but truthfully, then I think I don't really understand why the media is still spinning that he tried to come out lying about it when that's not really the case.
Okay, John Harris.
Two quick points. One, Ruth, as like me, a fellow veteran White House reporter during the Clinton years, I think we will recall that there was ample discussion, exposure of Bill Clinton's
personal life. Does anybody
remember
that?
So it's tattooed into my memory. We know more about Bill Clinton's personal life perhaps than any politician who's ever ever held the office of the presidency, even more than some people want to know, or many people want to know. So I don't accept that. Herman Cain was not blindsided by Politico. We put these allegations to him. In the first instance, we were ignored. Our inquiry was simply not responded to for 4 days. Then his staff came forward with answers. They revised those answers. And then once again, they stopped answering further inquiries that came up based on our reporting. And we know that they discussed this with Herman Cain. It wasn't a matter of just...
You know that.
I do.
You know that.
So it wasn't just a matter of his staff didn't tell him, hey, I'm getting these kind of, strange requests for information. So he was not blindsided.
That's very interesting because we've gotten a tweet that says any president has to deal with gotcha moments of real importance daily. How a candidate deals with them is telling. Ruth Marcus.
Well, I think there are two levels of relevance to the Cain story. The first is the legitimate questions of character that and the microscope that really needs to be applied to any leading presidential candidate. And the second is what the campaign's bumbling, and I think I'm being charitable here, response tells us about his governing skills and his response and organizational skills. I think they're both relevant.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's a comment on Facebook from David, who says, Herman Cain must really scare the far left. A whole show based on an allegation that can't be substantiated by victims who can't be identified. Harassment in the workplace is a serious subject of worthy discussion, but using it to cast a conservative candidate in a questionable light without any evidence is pretty low class. Really, Diane? Go ahead, Emma.
That's not a fair characterization, I think. Here we have someone who just held a press conference at the National Press Club about this matter. And he is in the front runner status in the Republican presidential campaign. That means that he, by inserting himself in that position, winning the trust of a large number of people in the Republican Party, has opened himself up to inquiry. And that's voluntary. Nobody forced him to do this. Now, the question then is there a slant in the lamestream media? That's a very common reaction of conservatives. I think it's not fair to say that Democrats have taken a pass. We can remember that Democrats have been impeached, put in legal jeopardy because of sexual harassment complaints. So I think it's a fair thing to say that people in corporate life, the Hewlett-Packard executive, people in political life, people on the bench, people in a lot of different walks of life, in the media, absolutely. So it's not liberal versus conservative. It's not the path or the type of job you have. It is your behavior.
All right. Where is this going, Ruth? How is this going to affect Herman Cain's candidacy for the presidency?
Well, first of all, my instinct is that the factual development of the story is going to continue.
Ongoing.
It's not going to stop here. Herman Cain said last night that he remembers one incident where he told the woman that she was the same height as his wife. That can't be the
sexual
totality of the story. I suspect we'll hear more. And I think that, as we've seen in this Republican race, you go up like a rocket and you can come down on the same trajectory. I suspect in the end, Herman Cain's trajectory was going to be going down anyway, and I think this may push it down maybe faster further.
John Harris, how much farther is Politico.com taking this story?
Well, we'll take it where our reporting leads us, and I don't know the answer to that, Diane. I do know that we have a bunch of questions. Some of them have been raised by callers to the show or the discussion that we've had in the show.
Give me an example
and we're
of
trying
the next
to
question you want answered.
Are we able to get more precise details of what the woman alleged and what happened in a very sort of moment-by-moment way, a TikTok is what journalists call it, once those complaints were leveled, what happened and what led to the outcome of these cases being settled?
John Harris, he's editor-in-chief of Politico.com. Emma Coleman Jordan, she's professor of law at Georgetown University. Ruth Marcus, a columnist and editorial writer for The Washington Post. And Erica Salmon Byrne, she's assistant general counsel and director of Corpedia, Inc. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Diane.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. From Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes in communities worldwide and supporting World Diabetes Day, novonordisk-us.com. And from Carbonite, automatically backing up computer files for individuals and small businesses worldwide. Learn more at carbonite.com. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama signed an executive order to ease shortages of critical medicines. But there are continuing concerns over the ability of drug companies to meet the needs of patients.